This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The International Monetary Fund has weathered many a tough headline recently for its handling of the European debt crisis and for the criminal charges facing its former leader. The IMF is no doubt hoping for a more friendly reception to today's news. The French finance minister is assuming the leadership post, the first woman to do so. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at allybank.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Tuesday. It is the 28th day of June. The International Monetary Fund picked a new leader today, Christine Lagarde. For almost 4 years, she's been France's finance minister. The IMF chose her over a Mexican economist who argued the fund did not need another European managing director. Lagarde will try to win over his supporters while she deals with the European debt crisis, the scandal over her predecessor Dominique Strauss-Kahn, and an investigation into an arbitration payout that she approved. From Washington, Marketplace's David Gurrow reports.
Christine Lagarde is unlike every one of her predecessors. She's a lawyer, not a professional economist, and she's a woman. Arvind Subramanian is a fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He suspects IMF leaders were asking themselves this question as they deliberated.
Will a European, you know, who's been in this business, who kind of has been close to, you know, the banking sector, will that person be able to take some of these tough decisions?
The Mexican candidate, Agustin Carstens, argued that the IMF shouldn't be so Eurocentric, that it needs to pay more attention to emerging markets. Subramanian has some advice for Lagarde.
She should try and ensure that, you know, the voting structure and the broader governance is more legitimate and more representative.
Right now, Europe has a lot of voting power within the IMF, about 30%. Subramanian says that could change if Lagarde says this to Europe.
You want more money from the rest of the world? Well, you can get it, you can have it, but in return, you have to reduce your representation within the IMF.
And give emerging markets a bigger role and more say about who gets help.
You know, the European crisis, as important as it might be, is only one of the items that she will be working on.
Domenico Lombardi is an economist at the Brookings Institution. He says Lagarde also has other things on her mind: morale issues at the IMF in the wake of the Strauss-Kahn sex scandal, and an investigation into an arbitration deal Lagarde approved. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Union workers walked off the job throughout Greece today in a two-day strike against proposed austerity measures. Dock workers prevented tourists from boarding ferries to the Greek islands, and a work stoppage by air traffic controllers forced airlines to cancel dozens of flights. A protest in Athens turned violent, and police fired tear gas into the crowds. The defining moment of the long-running debt crisis could come tomorrow as Parliament votes on a package of taxes and spending cuts. If they pass, Greece will qualify for the next chunk of bailout money. If they don't, the country could be bankrupt within a month. And then there's the plan to sell off some $71 billion worth of state assets, a government fire sale, if you will. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more on that story from our European desk in London.
It might be easier to tell you what Greece is not intending to sell. Martina Stevis of the Eleftherotypia newspaper says the inventory of Greek assets earmarked for privatization is colossal.
Ranging from banks, state-owned banks, to the loss-making railways, water companies, energy companies, ports.
And a couple of airports, a state lottery, a horse racing concession, a casino, and among many other things, a nickel mining and smelting company. Prompting the question, what was the Greek government doing owning such a vast ragbag of assets?
This was a dominant ideology in this country, that it is a matter of national interest as well as social solidarity that these assets are managed by the state, and the state claimed that it could do a good job managing them.
It didn't, in many cases, and selling off the loss-making companies at a decent price won't be easy. The government does have thousands of acres of real estate to sell, but developing it is another matter. Dogged public opposition can easily thwart the most promising project, and dogged opposition seems to be a Greek speciality right now. Commentator John Serapalis says the privatisation plan seems doomed to fail.
I don't think it's realistic to expect Greece to actually raise 50 billion euros out of sales and privatizations in a two-year period. I don't think it could happen.
Greece could be headed towards another humiliation. They put the country up for sale, but can't find enough buyers. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The last time PepsiCo came out with a new ad for its flagship product was 3 years ago. The soft drink giant was focusing its resources on its more healthful offerings. But now PepsiCo is turning its attention back to Pepsi itself, just in time for summer. Sally Herships reports.
Last night, Pepsi debuted a new ad. Its first in 3 years.
Santa, my man.
Making a Pepsi.
Pepsi?
Yeah, Pepsi.
But Mr. Claus, I thought you had a deal with, you know...
I'm on vacation.
PepsiCo wants to remind consumers to have fun again by drinking Pepsi, of course. For the past few years, the brand has been focusing its marketing dollars on its non-carbonated options.
The Gatorades, the orange juices, the Tropicanas, the waters.
David Silver is a research analyst with Wall Street Strategies. He says the lower calorie, healthier area is one where PepsiCo has seen an opportunity to pull ahead of Coke. But any successes that have bubbled up are at the expense of Pepsi. Last year, the seldom-advertised drink slipped below Diet Coke to the country's third most popular soft drink.
Tweens right now, when they start drinking soda, aren't really going to be looking for Coke and Pepsi if you don't market it to them.
Jeffrey Kleinman is editor of Beverage Spectrum magazine. He says this is a tricky time for soda companies. Pepsi is still near the top, but the entire category is going flat.
How well do you continue to keep up a brand that's slowly declining in share because the entire category is declining in share?
While building out your business for the future, Kleinman says Pepsi is advertising Pepsi again because it has to. Both Pepsi and Coke have splashed around with new drinks like coconut water, but soda is still the largest part of their business. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, a second day of gains on optimism about a solution for Greece. We'll have details when we do the numbers. In Moscow today, a Russian envoy met with members of the Syrian opposition and called for an end to any and all forms of violence. As Syria continues to crack down on protesters, more than 10,000 refugees have crossed into neighboring Turkey, and the Turkish government is making preparations to accept thousands more. It is an expensive situation for the Turkish government and a precarious one for the refugees. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports from Turkey.
There's a stack of sleeping mats and bedding in a corner of this house that almost reaches the ceiling. That's because for the last couple of weeks, more than 30 Syrian refugees have been sleeping here.
They were burning houses and fields and killing animals. They started shooting and killed two families.
This woman, who says her name is Lagia, crossed the border about 2 weeks ago with her six children. The youngest is 6. The oldest is 17. Her son, Ali, who's the oldest, showed me this video on his phone of the funeral of his friend whose throat had been slit by Syrian forces. Officially, there are just over 10,000 Syrian refugees in Turkey. The thing is, though, nobody knows how many more are living with relatives and friends. Suheyla Kornos is one of the Turkish hosts. She says having this many people stay is challenging.
They don't have anything. They don't have clothes or even shoes.
It's a lot logistically. It's even harder economically. A lot of the refugees are like Lagia. She didn't have much in Syria, and she left everything behind when she ran. But even people like her cousin Mehmet, who says he worked in construction and is quite well off in Syria, came with almost nothing. The Turkish government is only helping refugees who are living in camps. So it means these families are supporting their own on their own, and it's not like they have a lot to share. This tiny village, it's called Güveci, is really just a couple of dozen stone and concrete houses sitting on hills overlooking the Syrian border. Most of the people here are subsistence farmers. They have a few animals, some olive or fruit trees, but not much else. They say they have to help their families, but it's clearly a strain. Kornos, the Turkish host, says she's really not sure how much longer she can afford to support her Syrian relatives.
I used to spend 5 to 10 Turkish liras a day for food. Now it's more like 20. It's getting harder to survive day to day.
The refugee crisis is costing Turkey, too. Just down the hill from Güveci, thousands of people are living in camps, vast fields of white tents emblazoned with the Red Crescent's logo. The Red Crescent, which is in charge of the camps, hasn't been letting journalists in, and the police chase you away if they catch you trying to talk to people inside. But people there reportedly get 3 meals a day, medical care, clothes, all provided by the Turkish government. Turkey isn't saying how much the generosity is costing. Mustafa Kemal Dayistanli is the mayor of Yayladağ, where several of the camps are. He says having the refugees is like doubling the size of his town.
There are friends and brothers. It wouldn't be right to kick them out, but they've doubled our infrastructure costs.
The Turkish government will pay for it, so it won't come out of the town's budget. But like the families up the hill, it's also not clear how long Turkey can continue to support all these people on its own. And it could get much harder. As I was standing on a hillside in Güveci, looking at the makeshift camps on the Syrian side, these men came by. They'd come to Turkey to buy bread and other supplies, and they were getting ready to sneak back across because it's almost impossible to get food or water on the Syrian side. In Güveci, Turkey, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Coming up, they say a winner never quits and a quitter never wins, but maybe they are wrong.
People who are better able to let go develop your physical health problems over time.
The Freakonomics of giving up a dream. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow rose 145 points today, 1.2%, to finish at 12,188. The Nasdaq charged up 41 points, 1.5%, to wrap up at 2729. And the S&P 500 put on 16 points, 1.3%, to close at 1296. The Supreme Court declined to consider a 2009 ruling that forces tobacco companies to pay for an anti-smoking program in Louisiana. Lorillard, the maker of Newport cigarettes, and Altria, the parent company of Philip Morris, both fell more than 1.5%. Wednesday could be pivotal for Facebook and other online social sites. The gaming company Zynga is likely to file an IPO as early as tomorrow. It's the maker of the social games Farmville and Cityville. It hopes to raise as much as $2 billion through its IPO. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation, supporting customer choice and clean, efficient energy sources and technologies, working with customers nationwide to create a sustainable energy future. Constellation.com. By Manta, connecting millions of small business owners with new customers every day, on the web at manta.com. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
Every
every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen. Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Wednesday. The National Association of Realtors releases its monthly pending home sales index. The House Financial Services Committee travels to Hoover, Alabama for a field hearing at the National Computer Forensics Institute. It discusses the threat cyber criminals pose to individuals and financial institutions. And 55 years ago, President Eisenhower signed the Federal Aid Highway Act of 1956, funding the construction of thousands of miles of roadway. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Take everything this country spends on health care, government, employers, patients, and it rounds out to a little over $8,000 per person on average. But averages don't really tell the whole story. A study by the National Institute for Healthcare Management found that in 2009, 15% of us had no health care costs at all, while at the other end, 5% accounted for almost half of all healthcare costs, $1.2 trillion. Just who are all these big spenders? From our healthcare desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner tries to put a face on them.
Maybe you picture this high-cost patient as someone at the end of life, confined to a hospital bed and hooked up to expensive medical devices. But more likely, you'll find this person at home or in a nursing home, living with five or more chronic conditions.
Hypertension, diabetes, arthritis, cognitive impairment, heart failure, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. That's six right there.
Tom Bodenheimer is a professor of medicine at UC San Francisco. He says the costliest patients are typically elderly, poor, and have trouble taking care of themselves. Lisa Alexis with the Lewin Group, part of United Healthcare.
Well, if you can't take a bath by yourself, if you are unable to get dressed on your own, or you can't do your own shopping.
Having a functional limitation makes you almost seven times more likely to be one of the high spenders, because if you can't manage your illnesses, you end up going back and forth to the emergency room. Bob Hoban is chief strategy officer for St. John Providence, one of Detroit's larger hospitals. It employs 17,000 workers. Hoban dealt with his own health care costs by arranging for some of his employees, the nurses, to nag other employees, the ones with the chronic conditions.
To work with that individual to help them lead a healthier lifestyle. Are they exercising regularly? Are they following their doctor's orders on a regular basis?
Fewer than 1% of employees signed up to be pestered in this way, but the program worked. The hospital saved $8 million over 4 years by cutting costs for its highest spenders. Now, Hoban says, St. John Providence is marketing the program and taking it national. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
The economy may be in the tank, but a big U.S. travel organization says if the government made it easier to come here, billions of tourist dollars would flow into local coffers. The U.S. Travel Association, a Washington-based tourism trade group, recently sent a report to President Obama urging him to make it easier for people in emerging countries to get visas. People in places like China. Marketplace's China correspondent Rob Schmitz stopped by the U.S. consulate in Shanghai recently to see how long the wait for a visa actually takes.
In 1980, the U.S. issued 1,500 visas a year to the Chinese. Today, this single visa office in Shanghai processes 1,500 visas every 4 hours, and it shows. Waiting in line all day in the rain without an umbrella can bring out the ugly side of some folks. These two guys begin to shove each other for a position in a maze-like procession of more than 1,000 people that seems to lack a beginning and an end. But not everyone here is literally fighting to get into the U.S. Some are fine just complaining out loud to anyone who'll listen.
How come a developed country like the U.S. can't solve the problem of making people wait for such a long time outside the consulate? This is just a lack of consideration.
After standing in line for 4 hours, Zhang Weifeng is airing her grievances to the only American she can find, me. Better still, I'm an American with a microphone.
Why can't your country make a system where people go online, schedule an appointment, and avoid the lines? That would be more humane.
Humane. This is one of those rare moments when the Chinese are criticizing Americans for their human rights record. I redirected Mrs. Zhang's grievance to the woman in charge of visa operations for the U.S. and China, Consul General Linda Donahue. She says her staff is working overtime to keep up with a 40% increase in visa applications over the past year.
We would love to reduce the waiting time. Let me tell you that, because it's quite a strain on us when we are processing over 700,000 visas a year in Mission China. That's a lot.
And these visa holders spend a lot of money, more than tourists from any other country, $6,200 per person per trip. So do the math. Okay, don't do it. I'll do it for you. That's $4.2 billion. That doesn't include the 50,000 college students from China who spend bundles more over a longer period of time. They're getting a head start on all the spending here in line, where a microeconomy of ambitious salesmen selling umbrellas and sitting stools has sprung up. 16-year-old Liang San huddles under an umbrella with a couple of his high school classmates. They're all holding manila folders stuffed with the essential documents for a United States visa.
I have my passport and the payment, this certificate of deposit balance. Yeah, to show my I have the ability to come to America. I have to prove that my family could afford this.
It won't be hard to prove. He's already attending one of the most expensive private schools in Shanghai. One day, he hopes to work on Wall Street, but he'll have to wait. And here, he's getting plenty of practice. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
It is Freakonomics time. Every 2 weeks, we're talking with Stephen Dubner, co-author of the books, the blog, and as of this summer, a public radio show. How is your summer going, Stephen?
It's all right, Tess, but you know, I'm a Yankees fan. I'm getting a little impatient waiting for your Red Sox to start their annual collapse. But otherwise, things are pretty good.
Well, my friend, you're going to have to keep waiting because they already had their collapse in April. They are done and over with.
We'll see about that. But honestly, I'll tell you, instead of keeping track of wins and losses, which I usually do, this summer, I've been thinking about something a little bit different, which is who ought to be quitting?
Jorge Posada?
Oh, that's low blow. That's deserved, actually. But here's my thinking. You watch these guys, Adrian Gonzalez and Joey Votto and Justin Verlander, and you marvel at their baseball skills. But for every guy like that, there are, you know, hundreds of younger players. But the numbers say most of them are never going to get their chance. Out of all the American players drafted, only 11% will even make it to the majors.
Yeah, but if you're in that 11%, you're set for life, aren't you, at least financially?
Here's the problem. We human beings are pretty good at deluding ourselves about the chances that something good will happen to us. And too often, that translates into making a bad decision about when to quit something, not just baseball, but anything. So it all boils down to two pretty simple economic concepts. One is sunk cost, and the other is opportunity cost.
Okay, well, let's talk about those. Sunk cost, the time or money that you've put into something that makes it really hard to quit.
Right, exactly.
Opportunity cost, this is the idea that every hour or dollar that you spend on one thing, you're giving up the opportunity to spend that hour or dollar on something else.
Exactly right. So here's Justin Humphreys. He's a ball player that the Houston Astros drafted back in 2001. He was a very promising prospect, a big power-hitting catcher and first baseman. But after a few years in the minors and after some injuries, Humphreys wound up playing in an independent league, which is a team that wasn't even affiliated with a major league club.
Well, when you're 25, making less than $2,000 a month, at some point you have to tell yourself, I can't do this to myself. I can't do this to my parents, and I can't continue when I know there's untapped potential to do other things.
Wow, so talking real opportunity cost there, he had to weigh the cost of giving up on his dream against the actual financial cost.
Exactly. And he did the fairly rare thing, which is he quit fairly young, went back to school. His sociology professor at Columbia was Sudhir Venkatesh. So the two of them, Venkatesh and Humphreys, they teamed up to track the long-term outcome of every player drafted by Major League Baseball teams in 2001, which is the year that Humphreys was drafted. And here's Venkatesh explaining what they found out.
If you take two people who grew up in the same circumstances, let's say one played baseball and one didn't, the person who plays baseball is making about 40% less on average 10 years after they enter the game than the person who decides not to play baseball and who just wanted a regular career.
40% less? That's crazy.
It is crazy. That's what you give up by pursuing the dream that doesn't work out.
Well, so then if there's this proof that a career in pro baseball could be a really bad economic decision, why don't more players quit?
Well, you know the saying, right? A winner never quits and a quitter never wins. So as a society, we see quitting as failure. Hmm. But I'd like to challenge that a little bit. Sunk costs are just that. They're sunk. So instead of dwelling on them, you should forget about them. And this goes way beyond baseball. In fact, quitting, it turns out, can be good for your health. Here's Karsten Rosch. He's a professor of psychology at Concordia University in Montreal, and he has studied what happens to people when they quit what he calls unattainable goals.
People who are better able to let go when they experience unattainable goals, they have, for example, less depressive symptoms, and they have lower levels of systemic inflammation, and they develop fewer physical health problems over time.
So the problem here, Tess, is that neither Karsten Rosch nor I nor you can tell anyone else when their goal is, as he puts it, unattainable.
Right.
What I can say with some confidence is that we should consider the upside of quitting, or strategic quitting, as I like to call it. So, Tess, what do you say? Anything I can interest you in quitting today?
Well, I have to say, based on perhaps the example of Sarah Palin, sometimes it does pay to quit, right?
But, quitting upward?
Yeah, exactly. But I suppose in terms of me, let's see. In terms of sunk cost, I would like to give up on teaching my dog how to lie down, but way too much invested at this point, so we will persevere.
Nah, live with the lazy dog. It's okay. Just don't quit the show, okay? Just don't
Absolutely
quit the show.
Absolutely not. Never. Stephen Dubner, our Freakonomics correspondent. There is more of his work at freakonomicsradio.com. Thanks so much. It's been fun.
Good to talk to you, Tess.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Reputation.com, helping small business owners, professionals, and executives monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. Reputation.com. Marketplace is supported by Barron's Magazine, providing market ideas and insights to help readers manage their investments and protect their financial well-being. Online at Barron's.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research. On the web at Putnam.com/large cap equity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, as a general rule, we turn to the likes of Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke, economists, Nobel Prize winners, to give us their take on important financial issues like inflation. But in the Twitter age, everybody has an opinion on just about everything. So I guess it wasn't too surprising to read this tweet today. Have you guys seen food and gas prices lately? U.S. dollar sign will soon be worthless if the Fed keeps printing money. Now, of course the tweet was from Lindsay Lohan. She later clarified that her 2 million followers, that it was a sponsored tweet, but then added that, I actually do care about gas and food prices, so whether it's an ad or no, it's important for people to be aware of it. Indeed. And that is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 145 points, 1.2%. The NASDAQ charged up 41 points, 1.5%. And the S&P 500 put on 16 points, 1.3%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. And that is where you can turn for the latest in business and economic news. I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us back here again tomorrow.
This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.